an article out in the new edition of Political Quarterly called A Prosperity of Thought in an Age of Austerity, the Case of Ulster Loyalism by Pete Sherlow, paints a positive picture of attempts within Loyalism to develop a conflict transformation process. Though the article does not really distinguish between the UVF and the UDA, and so tends to bracket their transformation efforts together, it nevertheless provides a positive image of Loyalism and the attempts to move the paramilitary psychology away from a preoccupation with conflict to a preoccupation with preventing a return to that conflict. And I want to use some of the comments in Pete Sherlow's article to flag up what I think are important questions about the future and direction of Loyalism. Though positive work, of course, exists, and I'll identify some in a minute, Sherlow's article does not critically probe, I think, where transformation is actually heading, or whether it has or is attached to a discernible end point. And this problem is particularly evident with the concept of civilianisation, which in the article is attributed more to the UVF. Now, civilianisation means the action or process of converting a military position into a civilian one. Or to summarise Chris Coker's definition, it refers to using a civilian ethos to transform military functions of an army from within. In other words, civilianisation is a two-way process of using the values of civil society to transform the uncivil practices of a paramilitary organisation. It's using the values from without to transform what happens within. In other words, it's a relational problem. We should not forget, however, when considering this concept, that most Loyalist paramilitaries already move and live in civil society already, unlike an army fighting abroad which is being stood down when war has ended and so on. So they therefore live in accordance largely with these civil expectations and understandings. But when Sherlow refers to me in the article as saying at a recent roundtable discussion that UVF civilianisation process is little more than an extension of organisational control without relevance to public or political spheres, perhaps he should have gone on to say what I tried to say, which is that this process is seen as such largely because the UVF is not engaging with the political or social realm and therefore not making its case for civilianisation known, but is preoccupied with containing and controlling that transformation from within. So it's not surprising, given this tendency, it seems to me, that so much of society perhaps does not see the relevance of Loyalism when the UVF in the main refuses to communicate outside its own margins. Many times I've heard leaders say how the UVF does not respond to external pressure without much thought given to the possibility that that pressure could be harnessed to an internal dynamic for change, and that criticism could become part of a clarification process for their own transformation. Or that somehow this pressure that they're worried about doesn't reflect the perceptions of the civilian society which the organisation is trying to connect better with. So you've got a kind of dilemma there. And I think this refusal to interact with the public mood was especially evident after the murder of Bobby Moffat in 2010, when the UVF leadership, probably fearful of being seen to be losing control, decided to say nothing in relation to Moffat's execution. And I've argued elsewhere that I think that was a symbolic communicative act, not just an execution, it was the message that it conveyed. But nor did they say anything about the decision of Dawn Purvis to walk away as PUP leader. So it's hardly surprising that much of wider society in Northern Ireland sees the UVF and Loyalism more generally as irrelevant, or existing mainly to preserve criminal activity and the paramilitary reputations of the individuals when it acts in this way. My critique here is certainly not about personalities, a number of which I know and have been involved with, who perform hard and thankless work for change. It's a question or a critique about strategy, process and the search for meaning in a post-conflict society. Now, Sherlow argues problematically that the maintenance of militarised structures, I'm quoting him here, generally undermines the return to violence. But my question is, at what point are these structures likely to be wound up? And if they are not envisaged in this way, what's the overall objective being pursued? Or to put it in a more academic way, what's the meta-narrative here for this process of transformation? And when Sherlow argues that the UVF leadership is seeking to convert into a new structure, he doesn't elaborate on what this structure is and why it's necessary to exist as a new structure at all. Are we talking about moves towards a political party, moves into local councils, running youth clubs, community clubs, voluntary help groups, etc.? Or are we talking about the same structures run by the same people in an attempt to preserve what many people's eyes are redundant organisations for the infinite future. But most serious of all, it seems to me, is the problem of recruitment. Rumours abound that the UVF continues to recruit in numbers, and this is acknowledged by Sherlock too. But why is this so if the organisation is working to shut up shop? I mean, why would you want to risk absorbing more problems into a process which is difficult enough already, other than trying to use those potential problems to justify your continued existence? It's not good enough to argue that it's better to have trouble inside the tent rather than outside. Dealing with such trouble, and I understand there are problems around this, is also, or surely, a matter for the police now, less than the paramilitaries. Sherlow quotes a senior UVF source as saying that recruitment has been exaggerated, quote, but does not elaborate in comparison to what, nor is the question of why recruitment is happening at all addressed. He further goes on to argue that about 1,000 people have been through the civilianisation process, without giving any kind of intimation of who, why, how and to what end, what would have happened if they hadn't gone through that process, is there less of a propensity to return now because of it and so on. And although the numbers are sketchy, in concurrent with some of my colleagues, that would amount to roughly probably about 25% of the UVF over the last 5 years, or certainly since the statement of intent in 2007. Although one can't help thinking that this process was somewhat accelerated after the murder of Bobby Moffat in 2010. So the question is, what does it mean to have gone through this process, and what is one after this process in comparison to what one was before? And these are questions which I think were met with some silence in the piece. Now, the recent Northern Ireland Peace Monitoring Report does not paint a positive impression as that offered by Sherlock, referring to other things such as writing on the Short Strand in 2011, where the report says, quote, the UVF leadership on the Shankill Road continues to espouse a 2007 strategy, but it now seems carries little meaning on the streets of North and East Belfast. And then it reiterated a comment the IMC made in providing a somewhat sweeping overall assessment of lawless groups, as, quote, finding it very difficult to contemplate going out of business. Indeed, one striking feature of the changes we have described has been Alpira, however slowly, transformed itself under firm leadership and has gone out of business as a paramilitary group, while lawless groups lacking comparable direction have struggled to adapt. Now, on the point of direction, one has to look at the positives here. Projects like the Prison to Peace project, which addresses youth development, citizenship, schools education and social change, or the Belfast Conflict Resolution Consortium, which conducts work on gender difference, communities in transition, moving from confrontation to cooperation, conflict resolution interfaces, local leadership capacity, shared space, work on the legacy of conflict, or alternatives, which works on restorative justice, non-conflict community responses to crime and antisocial behaviour, or EPIC, which strives to help those who have been left behind by the peace process or disenfranchised by prison, or the Conflict Transformation Initiative, which strives to develop positive relations with former adversaries, community empowerment and peace building, which in connection with the churches seeks to build bridges with civil society. All are, of course, important in this process for change, but for me the key point is the last one, seeking to build bridges with civil society, which requires particular attention, since it's only really once wider society starts to see and understand the tangible benefits of development that the argument for change, I think, is likely to find a receptive audience beyond lawless themselves. We have seen there are leaders in the UDA who have had the confidence and the daring to some extent to present their case to the media and seek to challenge dominant perceptions of what the Neanderthal stereotypical lawless was, which surely absence from the media does very little to check. Those individuals continue to take considerable risks, it seems to me, precisely because they're prepared to face the difficult questions about lawless relevance stroke irrelevance, which appears to divide the mind of much of Northern Ireland beyond lawlessism. But maybe what's needed here to give these transformative projects real focus is some political intent. In other words, the initiatives, to use a metaphor, can be seen as a scaffolding of something, but I'm unclear on whether that something's going up or whether something's coming down inside it. So whether this political platform and representation, which may or may not emerge, comes from lawless joining the Northern Ireland Labour Party or some other grouping, I'd think, or get the impression, that what could help to cohere or bring these projects together is a common focused purpose that maybe the political platform might offer. If community development is also the way ahead for lawyers, then it seems to me This is surely a response to the absence of involvement by mainstream unionism to address these very issues and concerns that loyalists are dealing with. And as such, that signals a real gap that loyalist politicisation, it seems to me, can move into. Arguments that votes taken from the DUP would only favour Sinn Féin may be the case in the short term, but I think a community-based politics which has long-term purpose and which moves beyond the confined outlook of defence and immediate firefighting seems to me a ground that loyalism could possibly shape or at some point occupy. Now, these points are essential aspects for discussion if loyalism is to transform further in this post-conflict environment. And that is to, it must be seen to serve Northern Ireland beyond the immediate interests of loyalism itself, and much of this has to come from outside as much as inside. This is obviously a complex process, but it can be done. The problem to be overcome, it seems to me, is the tendency for fragmentation, individualism, lack of cohesion. A new imagination now is called for, which perhaps can develop this new direction. So the kind of some key questions or points just to finish on that maybe Jackie and Chris and so on can possibly elaborate, and then we can do so through the question and answer session, is that criticism can be a valuable instrument of clarification within loyalism itself, and it shouldn't be frightened to use that. But also, in mentioning very briefly the area structure and difference in the UDA in comparison to the centralised control of the UVF, it's clear that the speed of progress in the UDA is different in different areas. And it seems to me that the areas will work, or are likely to work, increasingly more independently as time goes on. This could or couldn't be a problem in that, is the transformation going to be pulled back by the more obstructive groups, or is the leadership of the more progressive elements going to be able to drag those obstructive people out of the darkness? The question also of why funders will want to keep funding initiatives that they think are keeping the organisations intact, also key, and also perhaps there needs to be a clearer separation in the public imagination between community initiatives and organisational initiatives, and when the two might meet or be distinct or clash. I want also kind of make as a last, I was going to say this, which is that any academic that thinks their work is more important than the subject they're studying should take a considerable look at themselves. But I'm not going to say it now. I'm just going to hand it over to Chris.